Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September the 17th. Well, I hope you had a nice weekend and didn't eat too much like I did. But after looking over the information contained in my guest's new book, or soon-to-be-published book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, maybe I didn't do my diet as much harm as I thought I did, except I probably should have skipped that piece of German chocolate cake. And I think you might be intrigued by what science writer Gary Taubes has to say about what really makes for a healthy diet and what doesn't. And we will welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Gary Taubes is also the author of a piece in yesterday's New York Times Magazine called Do We Really Know What Makes Us Healthy? And I jumped at the chance of talking with him just based on that title alone, because all of us care about our health and we are so confused over conflicting reports about what's good for us, which sometimes turns out to be what's bad for us, or vice versa. We'll find out why this is so confusing and why we hear so many contradictory things about the goodness of a certain treatment or vitamin or food, only to hear another thing from another study down the road. Gary Taubes is the author of the soon-to-be-published Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease. His article, Do We Really Know What Makes Us Healthy, appeared in yesterday's issue of the New York Times Magazine. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So is the answer to that question no?
Yeah, that's what I would say the answer is. The point of that article was to point out that the kinds of studies they use to tell us what's healthy and what's not. They're called epidemiologic studies, these huge studies of tens of thousands of people, are probably fatally flawed. And so it doesn't mean that what they're telling us is wrong. It just means that they're guessing whether it's right or not.
Yeah. The article focused a large part on the hormone replacement therapy confusion, I guess, when at first it was a godsend for women experiencing menopausal symptoms, and then we're all told stop taking this or die, and now we're told it's okay if it's temporary, but even that's controversial with some doctors.
Exactly. Those 40 years ago, women only took hormone replacement therapy. Well, it was then estrogen therapy, and you took it if you had discomforting symptoms of menopause. Then this idea comes around that maybe it'll prevent heart disease. And these big studies go to work, and what they do is they, again, the most famous of these studies nowadays is the Nurses Health Study run out of Harvard. 120,000 nurses, and they follow them. They send them questionnaires every couple years, and they ask them what they're eating and what drugs they're taking and, you know, how much exercise they do, whatever the researchers might think could have some influence on our health and well-being, and then they follow them for 10, 20 years, and they see what diseases they get, and you compare what these people did or what they ate or what prescription drugs they took with their diseases, and lo and behold, women who take hormone replacement therapy have like half the heart disease of women who don't. Seems like the drug cuts heart disease risk in half.
And then why did we get a different study down the road then?
Well, what you find out is what those studies actually tell you is that women who take hormones have half the heart disease and women who don't, but they don't tell you that the hormones are the reason. Because as it turns out, women who take hormone therapy do a lot of things different than women who don't, and they're just different women. On average, they're more educated, they make more money, they have different doctors, they have different diets, they have different everything. So the question is it the hormone therapy that explains the difference in heart disease rates? And the only way to know is to do what's called a randomized controlled trial, where now you start with 20,000 women, and at random you tell half of them to take the drug and half of them not to. And now you're what they call controlling for all these other different factors like socioeconomic status and other heart disease risk factors and education that might affect a woman's risk of getting heart disease. And they do those studies, one called HERS, which the results released in 1998, and then the Women's Health Initiative released in 2002, and now you get a different answer.
Yeah.
Now you find that heart disease doesn't isn't reduced in women who take hormone therapy. And suddenly the whole risk-benefit analysis for any particular woman gets flipped on its head. And that's the problem. So these observational studies, as they're called, give you, in effect, hypotheses. And you need the randomized controlled trials to test the hypotheses. And the problem, as I pointed out in the article, is more often than not, when you do the randomized controlled trial, you find out that the hypothesis was wrong. And yet we tend in this day and age to decide that we're going to live by the hypotheses because they sound sensible and they offer us hope.
Yeah, or it it got the most attention because it came out first.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and also it's a sort of somebody's telling you if you do this, you will live longer. Most of us will say, well, I'll take that risk. Then what they don't know, what you have to do the randomized controlled trials to find out is what the side effects are of this if you do this thing. So, you know, but most of us, and we want to know what to do. We don't want to get heart disease and cancer and all these other chronic diseases. So we want to do everything we can that seems reasonable to prevent it.
We are talking with Gary Taubes. He is author of the soon-to-be-published Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease. His article, Do We Really Know What Makes Us Healthy, appeared in yesterday's issue of the New York Times Magazine. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. If you have a thought or a question on do we really know what makes us healthy, or if you want to talk about what are good calories and what are bad calories, we'll talk more about his book in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6 here on the Ideas Network. Ben's guest after 5 says, while gifted children may benefit from enrichment classes and early education programs, their jam-packed schedules can also lead to negative consequences as adults. He talks with the author of Hot House Kids, The Dilemma of the Gifted Child, after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking with Gary Taubes, science writer, author of the soon-to-be-published Good Calories, Bad Calories. We'll talk some about his book and also about his article that was in yesterday's New York Times Magazine, Do We Really Know What Makes Us Healthy? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Since we have Donna in Menominee is with us. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Good morning. I actually have two questions. Mm-hmm. One, in a general sense, questioning the value of epidemiological studies. I understand their limitations, but most of the, for instance, occupational health hazards such as lead or PCBs or vinyl chloride have been identified through epidemiology. So I'm wondering if you think that in general epidemiological studies are without value. The other question has to do specifically with the China study, which has been referred to as the Grand Prix of epidemiology and has been quite influential. And I just wondered what you thought of that.
Good question. So I am very specific in the New York Times Magazine article about using epidemiology to establish the dietary and lifestyle causes of chronic diseases. Epidemiology has been tremendously successful in identifying the cause of infectious disease outbreaks, occupational hazards, as you say, adverse effects of pharmaceutical drugs, although that gets a little trickier to do. So, no, I am not questioning that at all. And also, most of us don't pay attention to those studies. If somebody finds out that there's some chemical that workers at a smelting plant work with might cause some toxic side effects, it doesn't make the newspapers. We don't read it. We don't change our lives accordingly. I'm interested in the studies that show up in the papers every day and the studies that cause, you know, tens of millions of Americans to decide to take a drug or change their diet or engage in exercise or whatever it happens to be. And those are using this tool, epidemiology, to try and establish the causes of common chronic diseases or to make us live longer. The second issue about the China study is interesting only because I I had a paragraph in the article on the China study, and then it was then removed. The China study was a lengthy study of, I think, some 50 or 80 counties in China, covering millions of people, comparing what they ate to the diseases they got. And then T. Colin Campbell at Cornell University wrote a book called The China Study, in which he claimed that this demonstrated that animal protein was the cause of the common chronic diseases, and we should all eat a mostly diet, mostly vegetable matter. And the reason I had it in the article is because T. Colin Campbell had a co-author at the University of Oxford, Richard Peto, who's probably the most respected epidemiologist around today. And the actual China study report, not the book that Colin Campbell wrote, but the report itself ran to about 800 pages. And you can get it online at the Oxford University website. And there is no mention, there are no conclusions drawn whatsoever in the report. Nothing about animal protein causing diseases. And what Richard Peto told me was that he just didn't think the data warranted any conclusions. There's nothing you could say from what they had learned that might tell you what's cause and effect. Colin Campbell, who went into the study believing animal protein was a problem, came out of the study believing animal protein was a problem. And that's the kind of problem I have with these epidemiologic studies. You can see into them anything you want. So if you go in with preconceptions, you can say the study confirmed your preconceptions. If you go in with a kind of rigidly scientific attitude, then you say, look, we learned nothing but how diseases happen to distribute between these counties. I tend to side with a scientific attitude on that one, and a lot of people would prefer to side with the sort of, you know, what makes a healthy diet based on what I already believe makes a healthy diet.
All right, Donna?
Yeah, although I also, the question I would have, and I am not a vegetarian, let alone a vegan, is that it does seem to me that there would also be a tremendous bias against coming out officially and scientifically and saying animal protein is bad for you in this culture. That's why I would question that a little bit. In other words, that itself is sort of a conclusion, except for, you know, a fairly small group of people, health food nuts and vegans.
No, that's true. I just read, you should go to Oxford University. If you search Richard Peto on Google, you'll pull up it's the Oxford University Clinical Trials Unit. And if you go to their website, they have the whole study online in a PDF file. Mm-hmm. And just look at the whole study. The other problem, here's, you know, my personal agenda against this. What Campbell and Peto found in the China study is that more urban environments have the more higher rates of the chronic diseases that we suffer from. And because they're looking at China, and because in China, and particularly the more urban you are, the higher your income, the more meat you eat, okay, you can say maybe it was meat, but the problem is maybe it's a lot of things. And what they saw in China was something that's been seen all over the world for the past 100 years. People move into cities, their diets become westernized, they get the common chronic diseases of Western civilizations, obesity, diabetes, some cancers, gout, arthritis, you name it. When they move into cities, when their diets become westernized, the other primary change is that they start eating refined carbohydrates and sugars. The China study didn't look at sugar. It's an 800-page report. You look and you could search it, you download it as a PDF file. You search for the word sugar, it'll show up 2 or 3 times in the report in tiny print. There is a line that says the Chinese used to eat virtually no sugar and now they eat more of it. So the question is, could sugar and refined carbohydrates explain what Colin believes is explained by animal protein?
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk more, that's kind of getting more into some of the subject of your book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, but we have another caller, I believe, on these studies. John in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've been completing the September issue of Scientific American, which is a special issue completely dedicated to the obesity epidemic, and there, one of the articles mentioned that they did a meta-analysis of this, some 200 studies done, And of the 100 that they could even look at, they said that they noticed a definite bias depending on whether it was sponsored by one of the food giants or whether it was an arbitrary analysis being done. They said that if there was a if it were sponsored by one of the food entities, one of the food corporations, there was a 4 to 7 times increased likelihood that they would find results skewed in the direction of favoring the interests of that entity that underwrote the experiment, and they gave all sorts of lists of, you know, the different factors that could cause a skewing of this. And John Starber and Sheldon Rampton wrote a book on Experts Where Experts Trust Us, Where Experts was the book. And they gave it's a book about the biases that go into scientific forming scientific opinions. But they did, in this latest Scientific American, they showed a study of weight loss by 4 different diets, and they found that the Atkins diet was the best by far as keeping calories off at a year. But none of them were very good. But they looked at the people that had lost between 30 and 60 pounds, and the one thing that was characteristic was they kept up a constant exercise regimen, and that seemed to be the critical indicator here. Also, this book goes into food as an addiction, and they go into the scientific explanations. But I just wondered if you comment on your opinion on specific diets, which in your estimation do well, and what other elements are necessary for keeping the weight off. That seems to be the big problem.
Well, that is, and I can guarantee you that my book will contradict virtually everything you read in Scientific American. Doesn't mean my book's right, but it'll certainly try and it sets out to refute, and I haven't even read Scientific American yet, but I can guarantee that it sets out to refute pretty much everything in there. Let's take your issues one at a time. The conflict of interest charge, which is that you get money from industry, you tend to find what industry what the funders like. It's interesting because that's another problem of cause and effect. Often when you have a theory that contradicts the current dogma, you can't get funding from the National Institutes of Health because the people who decide funding in the National Institutes of Health are considered the best people in the field, and they tend to believe the current dogma. So sometimes if you have research that falls outside of the conventional wisdom, the only place you can go for money is industry. So you go to the industries that will fund you, which are the ones that like what you're finding.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question is, are you finding what you're finding because they're giving you money, or are they giving you money because they like what you're finding? Also the conflict of interest charge, because in diet and exercise specifically, the National Institutes of Health, the government has a very hard line about what constitutes a healthy diet. Getting money from the government is also conflict. And I've had plenty of people tell me, you know, as this one fellow, David Krichewski, who passed away a few years ago, said, you know, the NIH is the biggest pusher out there.
Let me hold you there, Gary Taubes, because we're at a news break time, and then we'll continue talking more about good calories, bad calories, coming up after the news. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us on this Monday, September the 17th at 6:36. Do you believe that saturated fat and cholesterol cause heart disease, that salt causes high blood pressure, and that fiber is a necessary part of a healthy diet? Well, our guest this hour says there's no compelling scientific evidence that demonstrates any of that. He is the author of the book, soon to be published, next week in fact, Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease. Gary Taubes will answer your questions and respond to your views about this at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. He was also the author of an article that appeared yesterday in the New York Times Magazine, Do We Really Know What Makes Us Healthy? And we have a question on the table, so to speak, Gary Taubes, from a caller in our first half hour, John in Madison, who said that he was reading Scientific American, and they had a whole issue on obesity. One of the questions was, is the Atkins diet the best diet to lose weight, as I believe he said the authors of that article were saying?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, that I would probably agree with. One point I make in the book, and I spend an excessive amount of time doing it because I'd like to convince the medical establishment that they rethink their understanding of obesity, but the idea in the that what we got wrong about obesity is we think of it as a disease of overeating, excess calories. You eat too many calories, you don't expend enough, the extra calories accumulate as fat. That's the going wisdom. Thus, you're supposed to eat less and exercise, and everything's solved. Obesity is a disorder of excess fat accumulation, not overeating. Primarily, you have too much fat. And what people did 50, 60 years ago is they go and they look and you see what regulates fat accumulation. And what you find out is that the hormone insulin actually determines how much fat you accumulate. And what regulates insulin is carbohydrates. So the more carbohydrates you eat, or the more easily digestible the carbohydrates, the more insulin you secrete and the more fat you accumulate. And all Atkins did 35-odd years ago was come along and say, look, if this is true, let's see what happens if you remove carbohydrates from the diet. And lo and behold, you remove carbohydrates from the diet, people lose weight even if they don't eat less calories, because the carbohydrates literally make people fat.
Yeah, So, no carbohydrates whatsoever, or just the highly refined ones?
Well, the problem is, we all, there is a genetic element here, and if I'm right, the genetic element is the way we respond to carbohydrates. And so for some people who are very sensitive to the carbohydrates in the diet, they might have to eat virtually none to remain lean. Also, those of us, the problem is if we've been fat for a long time, and there's also another greater issue where each generation of Americans gets fatter, and that's probably due to an in utero effect of carbohydrates in the mother actually passing through the placenta from the blood sugar and then creating more insulin secreting cells in the fetus. So as we get fatter, we might have to eat less and less carbohydrates to keep the fat off. So for the simple question is, for everyone it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the brilliance of Atkins, I think, he got some things wrong, he got some things right. One thing he said was, if the problem is excess weight, first eat virtually no carbohydrates and get rid of the weight. Then when you get down to a weight that you want to be at, see what your body can tolerate. So if you miss ice cream, or you miss, the carbohydrates in broccoli, or you want to have a baked potato once a week, once you get down to your initial weight, then see what you can eat without regaining. Or if you say your baked potato once a week, you find out that you now weigh 10 pounds more, is that worth the trade-off?
Yeah.
But
isn't the rap against the Atkins diet and this theory is that most people cannot maintain this kind of a diet, that they simply get too bored or it's too strict and we want to eat that piece of cake every once in a while.
And that's absolutely true. The problem is, most people can't stay on any diet. Telling someone to eat less, we eat to satiate ourselves. If we try to eat less every day, then we're hungry all the time. So it's been known for, as long as there have been scientists interested in obesity, that you just can't tell someone who's fat to eat less and have it work. Not only that, when you eat less calories in total, your body adjusts by expending less energy. So even if you say cut your caloric intake in half, eventually your body starts cutting back the amount of energy you expend, so you're tired all the time. And you end up equilibrating calories in and calories out anyway. The problem with these low-carb diets is people assume that they work by getting you to eat less calories. And the point I make in my book is that, for instance, I'm an ex-smoker. What got me to quit smoking was the knowledge that cigarettes were going to kill me. If the only reason to quit smoking was that cigarettes gave me bad breath in the morning, I'd continue smoking because it's very hard to give up an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientific obligation here is to establish it, what makes us fat. If people are put on a diet and you know it's the carbohydrates that make you fat, it's a different equation than being saying, well, try this diet because it kind of works a little better than that diet, but none of them work really that well anyway. The issue we're interested in is what actually causes us to get fat. And unfortunately, the answer appears to be carbohydrates, the things people crave, bagels, pasta, bread. And when we were younger, I don't know how old you are, Joy.
Old enough.
There's a good chance that your mother, you know, parents believe throughout their entire life that bread, potatoes, pasta, rice, sweets are the things that make you fat. And the irony is, they are. They were right. It took the triumph of sort of modern medicine to convince us that they're actually heart-healthy diet foods.
Yeah. And at the top of the hour, I did mention, ask people if they're having some buttered toast for breakfast. And the cover of your book actually has a piece of toast with a big pat of butter on it with the title Good Calories, Bad Calories. You're trying to make the point that the butter is good and it's the toast, the white bread, that's bad.
Yeah, and that's funny. That's why Atkins, and my book is not about Atkins, but I just talked about him. That's why Atkins got pilloried 35 years ago. He said, eat as many fatty foods as you want, just don't eat the carbs. In an era when this idea that low-fat diets were healthy was just beginning to be accepted. So the medical establishment went crazy at the idea of this guy telling him that the healthiest possible diet is the exact opposite of what they were coming to believe was the case. And everything, what I did over the past 5 years is I went back and I looked at all the evidence to actually support the idea that saturated fat is bad. And because if this diet, if a diet of mostly meat products and cheese and eggs and fowl, it doesn't matter if you lose weight by it if you're going to die of heart disease. So the question is, are you really going to die of heart disease on such a diet? And what you find out is that the things, you know, that you can make a very good argument, a compelling argument, that the things that increase your risk of heart disease are precisely the same foods that make you fat, the same refined carbohydrates and sugar.
Mm-hmm. So your thesis, based on your research, is that the good calories are contained in things like meat, fish, poultry, cheese, eggs, butter, and it says here non-starchy vegetables.
Yeah, I mean, green vegetables, I think it's the kind of foods that my mother would have called a vegetable. She grew up in Brooklyn in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah,
and
corn doesn't count.
Corn is not a vegetable. Potato is not. Officially, scientifically, they're vegetables, but those are starchy vegetables. They have a high carbohydrate content per unit of weight. Most vegetables, green vegetables, broccoli, kale, spinach, mostly water. And what's not water is mostly indigestible fiber. And all the fiber does is sort of slow down the digestion of the carbohydrates inside, which is a good thing. But fiber by itself, it's the carbohydrates are the bad thing. The fiber only ameliorates the problem. So that what I would suggest, or what I concluded and what I now live by, and hopefully I'll live long enough that it's, people consider me a role model, is you get rid of the problem, which is these refined carbohydrates and sugars, instead of trying to add fiber to the diet or only be concerned about how much fiber you're eating.
We're talking with Gary Taubes. He is the author of the new book, soon to be published, a new book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease. He also had an article in yesterday's New York Times Magazine, Do We Really Know What Makes Us Healthy? 1-800-642-1234. Do you have a question about good calories or bad calories? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 7 o'clock, it's our state capitol report, and we'll get the latest on the budget stalemate. Is there a breakthrough in sight? We'll ask Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter, coming up after 7 o'clock. Right now, it's about 12 minutes before 7 on this Monday, September the 17th. We are talking with Gary Taubes, who is author of the soon-to-be-published Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease. Our number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. So, Gary Taubes, it says under one of your conclusions of your book is that exercise does not make us lose excess fat; it makes us hungry. So, do you exercise?
Yeah, I do. I'm actually an old beat up jock who's exercised his whole life, but I never lost weight by doing it. Not that that actually matters. The point again is, you know, this disorder, gaining weight, putting on excess fat, is all about a dysregulation of the fat tissue. You know, our fat tissue accumulates too much fat, and the question is, why does it do it? And so the idea that if we exercise, we'll increase the energy we expend, and then there's assumption that you can exercise and not eat more afterwards. And this is actually relatively new, because until the 1960s, the idea was if you exercise, if you went for a walk or took a hike, you'd work up an appetite. And I don't know the last time you took a long walk, but when you come back from the walk, usually on the way back, you're thinking about what you're going to eat. And so then
I work out like a fiend, because I feel if I don't, I will put on that 50 pounds that I took off 5 years ago. So I guess I'm under that assumption that my exercise is helping me keep my weight in check. Are you saying I'm all wet on that?
Yeah, basically. Chances
you.
Are your weight is exactly the same as it would have been had you not exercised, because what you'll do after exercise is your body is working to maintain an equilibrium between calories in and calories out. So if you expend more calories, your body increases intake. You know, so you get hungry. And if you try to suppress the hunger, then what will happen is your body will suppress expenditure later in the day. Maybe you'll sleep more, or you'll be a little tired the next day, you know. So you end up balancing out the calories anyway. What your body is trying to do is maintain a certain amount of fat in the fat tissue. In this weird sense, the fat tissue is driving everything. It's not the effect, it's the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And the regulation, so what happens, and I talk about this in the book, and theoretically this morning I'm supposed to be finishing a New York Magazine article on this very subject. There are these enzymes on your fat tissue that basically suck calories out of the bloodstream and pull them into the fat tissue. And while you're exercising, you suppress these enzymes on the fat tissue, and they increase on the muscle tissue. And what that means is, as you're exercising, the muscles can pull fat out of the bloodstream and use it for fuel. And then when you finish exercising, these enzymes turn down on the muscles, and now they turn back up on the fat tissue to replace whatever fat you lost.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that process of replacing the fat into the fat tissue that you feel is hunger. And all of this was worked out in the 1970s and 1980s in this particular case. And because the people who dominated the field of obesity were convinced this was a moral, psychological problem, that being fat is caused by people being gluttonous and slothful, they just ignored the underlying science.
Let me go to the phones. Mary in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. I did the Atkins diet a couple years ago for quite a while and was real successful. I lost about 35 pounds, but I got some tests at my doctor, and my liver enzymes were all messed up, and I found that, doing a little research, that can be related to that, and I was wondering if you had any comment about that.
Well, when they're talking liver enzymes, the question is, well, first, what are they talking about? Although, let me preface this with, I am not a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a journalist, okay? So I should stay away from giving medical advice. The key question with this diet, again, the key the thing I'm begging for in this book is for the nutritional obesity research establishment, the public health authorities, to treat this like a science. Okay, and the point of this, everything, you know, what the underlying science says, at least as far as I could tell, is it's the carbohydrates that make you fat. So if you go off the carbohydrates, first of all, when you're living on a high-carb diet, like most of us do in modern societies, your body is burning mostly carbs. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's burning, and it stores the fat, and that's why you accumulate fat over time. And when you switch to a low-carbohydrate diet, it's like changing the fuel that your car works on. So there are side effects to this transition. So the question is what your physicians are measuring this, you know, these odd numbers in the liver enzymes. First of all, are they odd just because they're odd compared to people on a high-carb diet, which most Americans are? So does this mean that these represent a chronic problem? Or are they measuring something that's caused by the transition from a high-carb diet to what's effectively a high-fat diet?
Yeah.
And if it's caused by the transition, then you're still going to be healthier when the transition is complete. But if they yank you off the transition in the middle of it because they don't like what the numbers are showing, yeah, you know, then you'll never. So this is the kind of thing that I'm hoping that the medical research community will actually pay attention to. I'm sure I'm being sort of, you know, crazily optimistic here. But if they, you know, they put their work to studying these kinds of effects, we might know, are these changes due to, you know, maybe after you've been living on carbohydrates for a long time, you can't get rid of them. Doesn't mean the carbohydrates didn't make you fat, but your body might adjust. Well, and these are things we don't know.
Gary Taubes, help us understand why the nutritionists and the doctors are not encouraging us to eat the way you're advocating based on science. Why are they encouraging us to do perhaps the opposite?
Because they believe, for reasons that mystify me, that saturated fat is the primary evil in our diet. I probably have some fans here talking to a dairy state. So if you believe that saturated fat is going to give you heart disease, then you cannot recommend a high-fat diet unless it's something like the South Beach diet, which is a kind of Atkins diet with healthy fats. They also believe that fat people have psychological, but that obesity is a behavioral issue. And they've been taught since medical school to ridicule anyone who says that obesity is caused by anything other than calories in versus calories out. So just by making this statement, you're treated like a quack. And if people will see, my book is kind of a little bit daunting, and it's basically because I'm trying to walk this tightrope between making writing a readable book for the layperson, but also writing a book that physicians can read and will take seriously. You know, it's got 150 pages of endnotes and bibliography so that every sentence virtually is documented. But these, you know, our medical research establishment has been taught for the past 35 years that anyone who tells you that obesity is caused by anything other than this calories in versus calories out equation is, in effect, a quack.
Barbara in Lake Geneva is with us. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm interested in knowing what do you think of sugar substitutes? I use Splenda.
I'll tell you, I actually, short answer because I know we're running out of time, I think they're probably better than sugar. You know, everything that I learned suggests that sugar is probably killed more people than cigarettes. And okay, I got that out. On the other hand, you know, you don't really know. Like, for instance, aspartame gives me a headache. So, you know, ideally, in an ideal world, again, one of the things that Atkins preach, you lose your sweet tooth with time. And that's probably the best to treat these things like an addiction and just try to break the addiction so that you lose the sweet tooth. Because your body can be fooled, actually. Your body can think that a sugar substitute is, or at least rats can be trained to believe that a sugar substitute is a sugar, and they'll secrete insulin in response to the sugar substitute.
Yeah. We only have a minute or so to go. There was a study that came out recently that said that those of us who drink diet soda and those who drink sugar soda are both in the same boat when it comes to increased risk of heart disease.
Yeah, that That speaks to the subject of the New York Times Magazine article yesterday. It's an interesting finding, but it tells you nothing about whether it's the diet sodas that cause the increased risk, or it's just people who drink diet sodas tend to be people, for instance, who have weight problems, and so they know they shouldn't be drinking, getting the calories in a Coke, so they drink Diet Coke. But now you've selected out a whole group of people who probably have a tendency to gain weight, and those of us who have a tendency to gain weight will also have a tendency to get these other chronic diseases when we eat carbohydrates.
Yeah. And one more quick one in 10 seconds, if you can. Should we avoid fruit, a caller wants to know?
Probably depends on your own. It's one of these things, and like, I get fat when I eat fruit.
Because it's a sugary carbohydrate.
It's a sugar and... You know, you get this sugar rush, and then 45 minutes later, you're hungry again. Now, maybe that's the kind of thing that, you know, I actually don't know the answer to, but I know that there's at least one person out there who gains weight eating
fruit. We'll look forward to seeing your book. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Gary Taubes, author of the soon-to-be-published Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.